Chris, Eddie, Linda, good to have you back as well. Appreciate the reading from Maverick this morning. Want to start off with a little bit of music history. Not a huge music buff, but went along with my lesson this morning. In 1979, just a few years before I was born, the American singer-songwriter Bob Dylan announced that he was a born-again Christian and released a new album entitled Slow Train Coming. The album contained Christian-themed songs such as Saved, Shot of Love, and Gotta Serve Somebody. Despite the album's popularity and platinum status, it came with a lot of sharp criticism from many people, including John Lennon, who recorded an obscene counter song entitled Serve Yourself. Now, whether you like Dylan's music or not is of really no concern to me or bother. Several of the songs that he penned during this phase of his life did carry some biblical messages. I listened to Gotta Love Somebody for the first time this week when I took an Uber from O'Hare to downtown Chicago. And there's a lot of traffic going on right now on the road, and so 20 miles was about an hour and 40 minutes. The ride with Richard gave me an opportunity to talk to him about a lot of different things, and I thought it was going to be a great ride when he got back in the car and I sat down, and on the back side of his cap it said, Jesus is Lord. I thought, all right, this is going to be good. Richard talked about his wife and his five kids, who were all roughly in their 30s. His youngest daughter, who called while we were on the ride, was down in Florida, saying that she'd got emails about all of his Medicare application coming through. He told me that he sold shoes at Saks Fifth Avenue there in downtown Chicago for 40 years and had just retired. And he was enjoying his time reading the Bible and sharing the gospel. We talked about the church at Ephesus and how they left their first love. We talked about the power of Christ to transform lives. That was his word. He liked to use the word transform. We talked about the sin of homosexuality. And of course, no conversation would be complete with a stranger without him bringing up Hebrews chapter 13, verses 1 and 2. Let brotherly love continue. Do not forget to entertain strangers, for by doing so, some have unwittingly entertained angels. And like many of you would have, I imagine the possibility. Richard was a black man who grew up in Mississippi and spent 40 years kneeling down to help people with their shoes. He said every day at work was a reminder of the time that Jesus washed the disciples' feet. I was refreshed by his sense of humility. And it helped that refrain from the song that was playing in his car from Bob Dylan stick in my head. Went like this. But you're going to have to serve somebody. Yes, indeed. You're going to have to serve somebody. Well, it may be the devil or it may be the Lord, but you're going to have to serve somebody. I assume Dylan had one or both of these two passages in mind. Romans chapter 6, verses 16. Do you not know that to whom you present yourselves slaves to obey, you are that one slaves to whom you obey, whether of sin leading to death or of obedience leading to righteousness? Matthew chapter 6, verse 24. No man can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will be loyal to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. This morning, I'd like to share a few thoughts and passages that encourage us to be fully committed to Christ and serving Him and Him alone. First thing I want to do is to remind us of our servant relationship with the Lord. Secondly, I'd like to consider a few of the many distractions that can separate us from the Lord. And finally, I'd like to offer two, maybe three, depending on time, biblical solutions to help us serve the Lord better and serve Him alone. All right, number one, a reminder of our servant relationship with the Lord. God's purpose, this is so important, God's purpose for creating this world and for us is for His glory and for the joy of His people in Him. And when we keep that perspective in mind, it's easier for us to appreciate our relationship to Him as servants. All the way from the Old Testament to the New Testament, there is consistency in the people of God being called to be His servants. Moses, multiple times, was called a servant of the Lord. Joshua said, "Choose you this day whom you will serve. But as for me and my house, we will do what? Serve the Lord." Paul himself describes himself as a servant of Christ. And he speaks of the Ephesian church and the members that are in it as bond servants. Jesus reinforces the message of servanthood as well. Listen to what he says in John chapter 12, verse 26. "If anyone serves me, let him follow me. And where I am, there my servant will be also. If anyone serves me, him my Father will honor." Here Jesus is trying to say that serving Him is not just a spectator sport. It requires following His footsteps in life as well as in death. We must follow Him to the cross and the grave. The term Paul uses in the book of Romans to describe our relationship with Christ as a servant is a unique one. He uses the term union. We are united with Christ. Romans chapter 6, verse 4 says this, "Therefore, if we were buried with Him through baptism into death, just as Christ was raised from the dead by the glory of the Father, even so we also should walk in newness of life. For if we have been united together with Him in death, certainly we also shall be in the likeness of His resurrection." That's the servant relationship with Christ, is union with Him in death and in resurrection. Do you know what happens when we are united with Christ in baptism? Well, it says that we are no longer slaves of what? Sin. You are no longer a slave of sin when you are united with Christ in baptism. It brings up a really interesting point that's critical to our Christian life. In baptism, we pass from being a slave of sin to a slave of righteousness, it says in Romans. We pass from one servitude to another. There's no interim space where we get to be our own master. You're either serving the devil in sin, or you're serving Christ in righteousness. There's no in between. Another really important point is that we are not capable, we are not able to break the bonds of sin on our own, are we? Reminded me of the song, I think it may be in the Blue Book, I'm not for sure. "Once like a bird in prison I dwelt, no freedom from my sorrow I felt. But Jesus came and listened to me, and glory to God, He set me free. He set me free, yes, He set me free. He broke the bonds of prison for me. I'm glory bound, my Jesus to see. For glory to God, He set me free." All right, a reminder of our relationship as a servant to God. Number two, what are a few of the distractions that can separate us from the Lord? Number one, and Jesus talks about this one probably more than anything else that we have recorded in the Bible, and that is possessions or riches. In Luke chapter 12, we find a man whose crops that year produced much more than he expected. And he said, "What shall I do? I have nowhere to store all of my crops." What was his answer? "I'm going to tear down these barns. I'm going to build some bigger ones." And he says to himself, "Self, let's relax, eat, drink, and be merry, for you have goods stored up for years. Let's take it easy." He says, "You fool, this night your soul is required of you." And then comes the crucial sentence in verse 21 there of Luke 12. It says, "So is he who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God." What does that mean? What does it mean to be rich toward God? I struggled with that phrase for a while. Surely it doesn't mean that we give God lots of money. He doesn't need our money, does he? He owns the cattle on 1,000 hills. Being rich toward God doesn't mean enriching his coffers. It means this. It means that we count God as our riches. He is your great reward. He is your wealth. Laying up for yourselves treasures in heaven would be like living in such a way as to maximize God as your ultimate treasure. The prodigal son is another good example of possessions that can separate us from the Lord. The son obsessed over wanting to have his inheritance so badly that he wished his father would be dead so that he could have his money right away. And as soon as he got those possessions, as soon as he got that money, flew away. Proverbs 23, verse 5. "Do not overwork to be rich. Because of your own understanding, cease. Will you set your eyes on that which is not? For riches certainly make themselves wings. They fly away like an eagle toward heaven." Possessions, money, can tear us away and separate us from God. What about pleasures? In his admonitions to young Timothy, Paul warns him of perilous times that were coming and the behavior of the men and what it would be like in those days. And among the sinful acts that Paul lists for Timothy there, Paul concludes his warning against those who are lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. But that's not the end. What's the next phrase after lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God? Does anybody know? He says that they have a form of godliness, but denies power. Don't let this be you. Don't be lukewarm. Don't serve God on Sunday morning and run to pleasures the rest of the week. I could list a whole line of activities that we all find pleasure in, but that's not the point here. The point is, Paul is trying to say that having only a form of godliness is like trying to serve two masters. There is nothing more exhausting than trying to live two lives. I'm convinced that this is the root of so much stress and anxiety for a lot of people, trying to live two lives, trying to serve two masters. Can't be done. Number three, another distraction in our life of service to God is pride. It's a twofold, awful, awful sin. Not only does pride separate us from the Lord, but it also keeps us from being reconciled back to Him. Someone once said that pride is both jailer and executioner. And I thought that was good. When Paul gives the qualifications for elders in 1 Timothy chapter 3, he notes that a novice should not be put in as an elder because he may be, quote, "puffed up with pride and fall into the same condemnation as the devil." Pride has been around for a long time, and it appears to also be the first sin of God's created beings. It was pride that tempted Eve when she desired to be wise like God, knowing good and evil. It was pride that convinced Adam to blame his wife Eve rather than admitting his own wrongdoing. It was pride that led Cain to kill his brother Abel. And it's the same pride today that threatens to separate us from our Creator. The fourth and last thing that can separate us and be a distraction in our service to God, besides possessions, pleasure, and pride, another P word, is people. If you're in college, and we have several this morning who are, or high school, or elementary school, listen up. Choose your friends wisely. Do not be deceived. Evil company corrupts good morals. In Matthew chapter 10, verse 34, Jesus has some really tough words for his 12 disciples. He says this, "Do not think that I came to bring peace on earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. For I have come to set a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and a man's enemies will be those of his own household. He who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me, and he who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me." So there's four examples. I'll start with P, about things that can be distractions and separate us from serving God. The last thing we're going to talk on are some biblical solutions that can help us serve the Lord and Him alone. Number one, keep your eyes on the Lord. An old Puritan, and I tried to find who it was, but I couldn't find it, but an old Puritan said this, "A hypocrite is like the hawk. The hawk flies upward, but he always keeps his eye down on his prey. Let him get up as high as he will, he is always looking to the ground. Whereas the Christian is like the lark. He turns his eye up to heaven, and as he mounts and sings, he looks upward, and he mounts upward." Be one of God's larks. Keep your eye fixed on the prize. Fixed on Him. I think this is what Jesus was referring to in Matthew chapter 6, verse 22, when He said, "The lamp of the body is what? The eye. If therefore your eye is good, if your eye is fixed on Jesus, and it's operating as it should, if your eye is good, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness." The author of Hebrews also has the word to say about keeping our eyes fixed on Jesus. In Hebrews chapter 12, verse 2, he says, "Looking to Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God." For all those in the audience this morning with an Apple iPhone, like me, when you get home, swipe right when you get on that home screen. And notice your average hourly time of screen time on your phone. How many hours per week is your eye on your phone? Is it more time than we spend reading the Bible? Is it more time than we spend in prayer or talking to our brothers and sisters? Keep your eye on the Lord. Number two, give generously. In Luke chapter 12, verse 32 through 34, we read, "Do not fear, little flock, for it's the Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. Sell what you have and give alms. Provide yourselves with money bags which do not grow old, a treasure in the heavens that does not fail, where no thief approaches and moth does not destroy. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." The way that this passage is written is a little bit difficult to understand, but there is a connection between the two parts of it. Laying up for yourselves treasure in heaven, and sell your possessions and provide yourselves with money bags that don't grow old. What Jesus is saying is that the second command is how you do the first one. Sell your possessions, give to the needy, and thus provide yourselves treasures in heaven. Hopefully that makes sense. I think the answer here for how you provide for yourself treasure in heaven is that you take your money and you show your freedom from it by giving it to people who need it. Money is not your God. It is not your treasure. God is your treasure. Barnabas is a man who clearly demonstrated that God was his ultimate treasure. In Acts chapter 4, verses 36 and 37, when he first comes on the scene, we read this about him. It says, Joseph, who was surnamed by the apostles Barnabas, which means son of encouragement, a Levite, a native of Cyprus, sold the field which belonged to him, and he brought the money and laid it at the apostles' feet. That's all it says about Barnabas for now. But several chapters later, in Acts, we meet up with Barnabas again and find out about all the wonderful things that he's doing. He's an advocate for the new convert, Paul, that was murdering the early Christians. He encouraged the Gentile converts in Antioch. He was one of the trusted that gave relief to the poor. He was the first partner of Paul on his missionary journeys. And he was also the one who is an advocate, giving John Mark a second chance when nobody else would. Barnabas shines as one of the most mature, reliable, lovable leaders of the early church. But where did it all begin? It all began in Acts chapter 4. That's the point of those two verses. Luke shows us that Barnabas' ministry began when he demonstrated freedom from the love of things and a heart of generosity towards others. Number three, and the last one, slow down. Of all the passages in the Bible, I cannot recall one where we find the Lord being in a hurry. After 6 days of work in creation, God took time to rest. Not because he was tired, but to model for us a life that is patient and thoughtful, reflective, and full of purpose. Even Jesus was not one to be rushed. We see Jesus do a lot of walking in the New Testament, but we never read of him running. The only place that I could find where Jesus may have picked up the pace was in Mark chapter 10, verse 32. The scene is just before his crucifixion. He's with the 12, and they are headed to Jerusalem. It says this, "Now they were on the road, going up to Jerusalem, and Jesus was going before them, and they were amazed, like he'd never been out in front. And as they followed, they were afraid. And he took the 12 aside again and began to tell them of the things that would happen to him. Behold, we're going to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be betrayed to the chief priests and to the scribes. They will condemn him to death and deliver him to the Gentiles. They will mock him, scourge him, spit on him, and kill him. And the third day, he will rise again." As much pain as he knew that he was going to have to endure, I think he was filled with joy to be able to fulfill the will of his Father. And he was out front, leading the way, maybe walking faster than he ever had before. And it amazed the 12. As I reflect on that passage, I'm struck by how different Jesus' hurrying is from our own hurrying. We often live as if our limits don't exist, trying to do too much, trying to be too much, when all God really wants is our heart. He's not interested in our trophies. He's not interested in our titles. He wants the heart of a servant. You're going to have to serve somebody. Yes, indeed, you're going to have to serve somebody. Well, it may be the devil, or it may be the Lord, but you're going to have to serve somebody. This morning, if you have not given your heart to God, then you are a slave to sin. Come to Jesus, be united with Him in baptism, and He will make you a servant of righteousness. Set aside the distractions of this world. Keep your eye on Him as the lark. Give to other people, especially those of the household of faith, and take time to be holy. If this morning you're not part of the house of God, you're missing out on something very wonderful. We would invite you to come and join in that as we stand and sing a song of encouragement.